Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, another in our series of conversations with the candidates. Maryland Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford joins me in Studio A. In a Gonzales poll released early this morning, Governor Larry Hogan enjoys a 16-point lead over Democrat Ben Jealous. If he sustains that lead through November, he'll be the first Republican governor to serve a second term since Theodore McKeldin in the 1950s. Boyd Rutherford has chaired a task force on opioid abuse, worked on public-private partnerships and regulatory reform, among other issues. What has the lieutenant governor accomplished in those areas, and will he continue focusing there or change his gaze to other issues if he and Mr. Hogan are reelected? Boyd Rutherford joins me, plus political analysis from the Baltimore Sun's Luke Broadwater when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Today, another in our continuing series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford, who was elected with Governor Larry Hogan 4 years ago. They are running against Ben Jealous and his Democratic running mate, Susan Turnbull, in the November election. Before becoming the lieutenant governor, Mr. Rutherford worked in both the public and private sectors. He holds an undergraduate degree from Howard University and a law degree from the University of Southern California. He practiced law in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and here in Baltimore. During the 2000s, Mr. Rutherford held positions in the U.S. General Services Administration, later serving as Secretary of the Maryland Department of General Services, and later as Assistant Secretary for Administration at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Mr. Rutherford also served for 2 years as the Chief Administrative Officer with the Republican National Committee. Boyd Rutherford is 61 years old. He and his wife Monica reside in Columbia. They have 3 adult children. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. You can send us a message there, and we'll begin taking your calls and comments a little bit later in the program. Mr. Rutherford, it's good to meet you. Thanks for coming
in. Good to meet you. Thank you for having me.
So the duties of the Maryland Lieutenant Governor, as defined in the Constitution, are delegated to him by the governor. So what has Mr. Hogan delegated to you, and how's it going?
Yeah, the only duty really officially of a lieutenant governor is succession. So it's what the governor has asked me to do, or what I have asked the governor, if he doesn't mind, if I take on. The first thing that he did ask me to do when we were campaigning was to take on the heroin issue, the heroin and opioid issue. And so after, you know, being elected and sworn in, we put together a task force, our heroin and opioid emergency task force, brought together various individuals who had been involved in the fight for years, both treatment professionals, advocates, a parent who had lost a child to an overdose, a former sufferer from substance use abuse or substance addiction, and tried to come up with solutions. And we came up with 33 recommendations in our final report. We had some immediate recommendations. We put out an interim report, things that we could take, steps that we could take right away. In the last several years, we've been implementing. Some of them were legislative. And we kind of approached it from multiple areas, but basically starting with education and prevention. As I would say often, we needed to cut off that pipeline of new users so that we can address those folks who are currently suffering. So then treatment was very important, and there's also a law enforcement element. But for the most part, it was focused on prevention and treatment.
And
aspects.
This is an intractable problem, it seems.
It's,
I mean,
it's
when
a
you
national
started
problem.
2015, 2014, yep. Here in the city, there were 275 deaths from opioids. In 2018, that number is expected to go well north of 800.
Yes.
So the recommendations and reports are great, but what strategies need to be adjusted? How do funds need to be allocated, and what focuses need to be
Definitely a lot of funds with regard to treatment. We need to make sure that we have treatment available. One of the things we did in the last year is we funded the Stabilization Center here in Baltimore. But one of the things, when you look at the folks that are dying from the overdoses, the big surge is fentanyl, which was not a factor in 2014 or even 15. Mm-hmm. Fentanyl, which is 50 times more powerful than morphine, is being mixed with heroin and other substances, cocaine and other things it's being mixed with, and it is killing people.
So what strategy needs to be adjusted to deal with this very, as you say, harsh and new reality?
Well, you know, there's a combination of the law enforcement side, because fentanyl, because it's so powerful, it can come in small containers or packages. A lot of it comes through the U.S. mail, unfortunately. The package freight companies
right from
have done
China,
better,
right?
Directly from China. And it's not just an issue here in Maryland. It's a national issue and actually international issue as well. Other countries are having this problem. When you look at the demographics of the people who are suffering and dying, particularly here in Baltimore, it's older population. It's 45 and above. So many of these individuals are long-term heroin users that their systems can't take this more powerful fentanyl. And in some cases, people, of course, as we get older, and if you've been a long-time user, your body starts to break down anyway. And so we have to make sure that we have treatment available for those who are ready to have treatment. And then the next step beyond that is making sure that we have transitional housing for people when they come out of the initial treatment. So because many people are not ready to go back to their communities where they were before, and all the stimuli that may have led to or helped them continue to utilize these drugs. And of course, most cases, they burnt bridges at home. So the family structure is not necessarily there, so they need to have that transitional place.
And the national economy is booming. The Maryland economy is doing quite well, as are virtually every other state. Mm-hmm. Maryland's flush right now, relatively speaking, when it comes to resources. Are the resources going to be there to take on these new things? We're going to be taking care of a lot of people.
We are taking care of a lot of people. We're putting a lot of money into, there's some close to $6 billion that's spent when you look at all of the health programs that are in place, the additional monies that have been put in the last several years from our administration in terms of addressing these issues. A lot of that money is going directly to the localities, going to Baltimore City, going to the counties, because we don't want to take a top-down approach. We feel the locals know best about what is going on in their jurisdictions. Harford County's issues are very different from what's happening here in the city. And so we're, you know, making sure that, you know, a Dr. Wynn or the health professionals in Harford or Baltimore County are able to address the concerns they have. So one of the reasons we set up, or the primary reason we set up, put Clay Stamp in charge of our opioid operation command center, was to have a better coordination with the locals with regard to addressing this challenge.
Boyd Rutherford is my guest. He's the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Maryland. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We will take your calls and comments a little bit later in our broadcast. Lieutenant Governor, what's your working relationship with Larry Hogan? And can you point to any particular issues or areas in which you've had a direct influence on his thinking?
It starts with the fact that the governor and I are friends, and we were friends before all this. We weren't kind of a match made of convenience or anything of that nature. I definitely didn't have a bunch of money to bring to a campaign or anything of that nature. Our families entertained with each other prior to this whole, you know, governor, lieutenant governor stuff. His middle daughter and our son went to high school together. They knew each other before we knew each other. And so for years, we had been friends. And so when the governor decided he was going to run and he asked me to join him, he thought there was something I could add because of the experience you mentioned in terms of government in particular. I wouldn't say I jumped at the opportunity, but I decided to, you know, it was a good time for me to take this step, and I thought there was something I can add. In terms of our relationship, we decided early on, and I'd say largely myself, that we would have a joint staff. I didn't want to have a separate staff. Typically, lieutenant governors, at least in recent years, could have maybe 12 to 14 in their immediate staff, the office of the lieutenant governor. Separate communications people, separate chief of staff, and other people that are working on projects. I said, I don't want to do all that. We should have one chief of staff. We should have one communication shop. Heaven forbid you want me to be out there saying things that are different from what the governor is saying and vice versa. So we have been working together in a lot of areas. I think some of the discussions with regard to opioids is something that, you know, have had an influence because I've been much more directly involved in that. He's asked me to really take on the procurement modernization, and so, you know, helping him to understand the procurement system. He is a small business person, and so he's very familiar with business and how business operates in the commercial market, but not necessarily the business relationship between government and businesses. And then also minority business, because my background has been in advocating and supporting and representing minority businesses, that's an area that I think I've helped him to understand the challenges that minority businesses face.
What would you point to as the best, the biggest achievement of these last 4 years? I mean, it would be that legislative achievement or in any other way?
Well, I mean, I think there are a number of things. We've been able to change the dialogue with regard to taxes and fees and in the state, where it's for year after year and session after session, it was what taxes could be increased. I think that was a big thing. Probably our biggest achievement was maybe the first year, and that was the Justice Reinvestment Act, getting that through with bipartisan support. You know, one of the things, and you're probably well aware of, is that Maryland, fortunately, we're now leading the nation in terms of the reduction of our prison population. And so, you know, that is partly due to a lot of factors, and even including recommendations that we made in our heroin and opioid emergency task force, was to treat individuals and nonviolent offenders who may have an issue associated with addiction differently from a violent criminal. You know, I like to say we want to make a distinction between those people we're upset with because they may have done something, they may have stolen something from us, they may have broken into our car, but their real issue is their addiction and not that we're afraid of them. And so the people who we're afraid of, they need to be taken off the streets and they need to go to jail. But the person who has this issue, we need to get them treatment. So those are things that we've been working on, and we feel very proud about.
When it comes to incarceration, number of bills have, you know, wound their way through the legislature over the past 4 years, and there are those who point to a sort of predilection or a general proclivity on the part of the governor to look at sentencing. Truth in sentencing is a phrase that he utters quite frequently, mandatory minimums. Yet there's a full body of evidence, a lot of evidence, data that indicates that incarceration in that way, in approaching the problem of violent crime, which is, of course, near and dear to the hearts of people who live in cities like Baltimore or some of the other larger cities in our state, is ineffective long-term. And what it does to communities, what it does to long-term prospects for people who are being incarcerated is not the right approach.
Well, I think the distinction really is the nonviolent offender versus a violent offender. And what the governor said over and over again, we've all said that, is we're concerned about those repeat violent offenders who are not serving the time, that they're getting out on suspended sentences, or they're, you know, getting, you know, just a plea bargain that they're not going to jail. And we've seen that. We've seen that occur in some of these incidents that have happened in the city where the person has had prior offenses where they were just basically slaps on the wrist. So we're saying we have a mandatory 5-year law that's been on the books since before we came in for gun crimes. But it's not often used. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the violent offenders, and in many cases, the repeat violent offenders. We're not talking about the guy who's selling weed on the corner, or, you know, somebody who does something that's nonviolent and they go to jail or they go get locked up for 20 days or something of that nature. We're talking about the really bad guys out there. So that's, you know, there is a distinction. You got to take some of these folks off the street.
Boyd Rutherford is the incumbent Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. He is standing for re-election with Governor Larry Hogan in November. We will continue our conversation with Lieutenant Governor after a short break. When we come back, we will try to work in some of your questions and comments. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on Education with the new academic year set to begin in just about 3 weeks. We will spend the hour with three Baltimore City Public School teachers. Karen Ginyard is a third grade teacher at the Mount Washington School. Tavon McGee is a middle school math instructor at City Springs Elementary Middle. And Bobby Marinelli heads the math department at Poly High School. So we'll get their perspectives born out of their experiences in the classroom tomorrow. On Midday, if you've just joined us today, my guest is Maryland's Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford. This is our latest installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. Maryland is one of 45 states who have an office of Lieutenant Governor. In two of those, the position is held by whomever is the leader of the upper chamber of the state's legislature. Five states do not have the position of Lieutenant Governor. We welcome your questions and comments for the Lieutenant Governor at 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. We have the Lieutenant Governor for about another 20 minutes.
As you know, I'm the only the seventh Lieutenant Governor in the state of Maryland.
That's right. This was a statute that entered the Constitution in the 1970s.
Yeah, there was Marvin Mandel, after Agnew left and it went to the legislature, and of course the House is bigger than, you know, House of Delegates is larger than the Senate, so they elected the Speaker, who was Marvin Mandel, and someone said, you know, we should have a succession plan. Maybe it's not a bad idea.
I think people are, many voters have an inclination to think that split government is a good idea. Mm-hmm. So here in Maryland, a heavily Democratic state, we have a Democratic legislature, right. And now we have a Republican executive branch. But in this era, mm-hmm. what does a two-party rule mean, given the fact that the head of the Republican Party nationally is such a divisive figure, Mr. Trump?
Right. Right.
So what does it to you, and I assume you've been a member of the Republican Party for a long time, predating your run for office.
Yeah, good number of years.
What does it mean to be a Republican in the age of Trump?
Well, it is, I'd say, a tightrope that we walk. But in terms of two-party in Maryland, I think what it does is it's very healthy to have an opposition party. You need to have an organization or a group that is questioning, you know, the status quo. And, you know, one of the things that I tell people all the time, and, you know, when we talk to people in the community, we're talking to different individuals, and they're, you know, complaining about how things had been or lack of access to, you know, the elected officials or whatever, or why isn't this kind of thing being done or whatever, or other. We said, you know, because in Maryland we've been out of power for so long, almost forever, we don't have the baggage. We don't walk in with these, you know, groups that are so invested in the party that they keep you from making change or even thinking differently, bringing up a different argument to say, look, maybe we should do things a little differently. And it can be in education, it can be in economic development, it can be in the delivery of healthcare, it can be delivery of services, how we address mental health issues. You know, there's not the vested interests that have been supporting, let's say, our candidates for a number of years because we've been out of power. We've been, you know, so there's not all these friends, like I would say, that are saying, no, you can't really talk about this, or the power structure says you can't do this, because there is no power structure when it comes to Maryland Republicans.
There's an email from Steve in Baltimore. It says, you were the Secretary of General Services from 2006 to 2009. You were an architect of the State Center redevelopment project during the Ehrlich administration. Mm-hmm. So here we are 12 years after the ribbon cutting and nothing's been done. And Governor Hogan has sued the current developer, who has countersued the state. So what would a Hogan-Rutherford administration do to move this project forward and be a catalyst for the surrounding area of Central West Baltimore? This is a controversial move on the part of the governor. The last poll that I saw said 75% of voters think State Center in the deal that was proposed was a good idea.
Well, I don't think they understand that deal. That deal would have required the state to pay rents equivalent to as if we were down at the Four Seasons in Harbor East. $55 a square foot is way out of line of what a state should be paying in rent for a property. And the deal is very different than what we envisioned when I was Secretary of General Services. The marketplace is a lot different. And what happened then, if you remember, Bill Strievers went bankrupt, during that time because the marketplace had pretty much. He was the lead developer on the State Center project. The marketplace changed. It was planned to have condominiums or possibly apartments if condominiums didn't work, as well as commercial office space there, as well as state office space. That completely changed when the market changed. It was after my time, but the market changed, and then it got converted to all office space to be there, pretty much to do what we have there now, just with newer buildings. The deal is
but
not a good
some
deal.
Retail, a grocery store, and
they didn't have a grocery store. They were talking about a grocery store, but they didn't have a grocery store. They wanted to put it in the armory, but they didn't have that locked down. There was a lot of promises, but the main thing that they were looking for was the state to pay $55 a square foot, which is the same as down in East Harbor, which
but
is
all those
commercial
neighborhoods, all those neighborhoods very much wanted this project. I mean,
and we would like to do redevelop that project. We just got to get this development team out of the way. They didn't have experience doing the kind of work that they're talking about doing. It was a lot more pie in the sky than what was reality. And so once we get them out of there, we're ready to move forward with real development, maintaining a state presence, bringing in retail, particularly getting a grocery store over in that area, as well as maybe connecting a little bit better with MICA that's right down the street.
And you are confident that a brand new deal after all of this time, all of the money that's been invested so far.
I am confident. I don't know about a whole lot of money other than drawings. That's what we're debating on now because they never put a shovel in the ground. So they're talking about a lot of money that they supposedly spent. So we would think architects and maybe some attorneys they spent money on, but they have drawings. They never put a shovel in the ground. And I want to point out that, you know, during the time that I was not in office and not at General Services for those prior 8 years, nothing happened either. And even when they took these leases to the Board of Public Works and Governor O'Malley's very last Board of Public Works, the treasurer and the comptroller rejected it, and they took them off the agenda. So, and then eventually all three members of the Board of Public Works, the comptroller, the treasurer, and the governor, rejected these leases because they were not done properly.
The other two issues that are of great import to folks here in Baltimore and Central Maryland are transportation issues. Mm-hmm. Governor rather famously abandoned the Red Line project early in his tenure, and the redevelopment of Pimlico. You chair another commission called the Intergenerational Poverty Commission, and you're talking about, and I think it's a really good thing to concentrate on, the poverty that is somehow, you know,
multi-generational,
bequeathed to right. to people's progeny. Isn't transportation a central factor to bringing people out of economic distress?
It can be, and particularly if you do transportation well. The Red Line, I don't think, was well thought out. It would have been a third $3 to $5 billion transit line that didn't connect to the other two transit lines. So, I mean, if you look at New York City, if you look at Washington, D.C.'s metro, those are systems. You can transfer from one train to the other to get to various locations. We put in Maryland, we put in the Baltimore Metro, which is one line that goes from one point to another point with stops in between. Then later came in the light rail that does not connect to the metro. There's one point where it's maybe two blocks away. There's not transfer services to go from one to the other. And they were going to put in a third complete line that would have run not connecting to any of the other two lines. That just didn't make any sense. So that was, you know, and for the estimate to be about $3 billion, and we know that government estimates, particularly on transportation, particularly when you're going to go into the Inner Harbor, which is all water. I was secretary when we built the Reginald Lewis Museum, which is about a block from the waterway. When we went down to form those foundations, we hit water. So we would have been building a tunnel underneath, basically another harbor tunnel underneath Pratt Street, and it would have been all water. So it would have been about $5 billion at best. So we just felt it was not the right deal. If you look at the Purple Line, which we did go forward with in Montgomery County.
And the whole other area of the state.
Yes, we did go forward with that, but it connects several stops with the metro. So it's, you know, it is part of a system That is the big issue associated with the red line.
Without getting too deep in the weeds about whether the red line was a good idea or a bad idea, there lot of folks who thought it was a very good idea in terms of the compromises that have to be made.
The engineers and all the people who were going to make money off of it thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
But nobody disagrees with the need to get people from the west side to the east side.
And that's
how difficult
work.
It is to do now. And the bus system, this Baltimore Link system, which the governor has proposed and has, you know, put into effect now for a year or two, is not living up to expectations, at least according to the folks that I talk to who ride the bus every day.
There are some people, I mean, you talk to Councilman Dorsey, he thinks it's great. You look at the tweets that he sends out almost every day. He says it's good. The National Association or the American Association of Transportation Professionals awarded it an outstanding innovation award for smaller projects. So there's a positive associated with it. You know, and just who used to ride the bus all the time when I was much younger, you know, people always complain about transportation. You know, there's always going to be some concerns. We can always do better. There's some things we can probably do better with the streets as well to make sure that they are, you know, they flow better and making sure that the traffic lights are timed appropriately. As we saw a couple of weeks ago, there was a big issue and they reset the timing on the traffic lights. If we make sure that those are done properly so that the buses can get through and we enforce the bus lanes, I think there could be some better transportation options.
So you think that the current system is as good as it's going to get?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying it's good. I said that there can be improvements to some of our streets and how we move traffic, the flow process, making sure that our traffic lights are timed appropriately. There's technology that can be used where the buses can have some control over the traffic lights to be able to get through quicker. So there are things that can be done. And, of course, our equipment can be a little better. We can continue to improve our equipment.
Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford is my guest. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go to a phone call. Lieutenant Governor, this is Will in Towson. Welcome to the program. Hi, Will.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. My question for the Lieutenant Governor was just, as a younger, more progressive, registered Democrat, I've been following some of the things he and the governor have been doing. I didn't vote for him, but I am open to doing so in the coming elections, and I just wonder what he would say would set them apart as far as walking that tightrope in an age of polarized bipartisan politics. What kinds of things are he and the governor going to continue doing for Maryland that's going to make him a more appealing choice than someone who maybe would normally align a little better with my beliefs in general?
All right, thanks for the call. Okay. We'll appreciate it.
Well, hopefully, you know, the things that we've been doing over the last several years, you've seen that we've been governing in a bipartisan way. We've been working with the legislature when we can, you know, and not getting marred into partisan bickering. We've been able to get legislation through that, you know, our priorities for us that we've agreed to and work the art of the, you know, the legislative process with the leadership as well as the rank and file in the legislature. So we've been governing in a bipartisan way, and we'd like to feel that we've had accomplishments, not just the fact that the economy is doing well, but a lot of the legislation, as I mentioned, the justice reinvestment, what we've been doing in terms of violent crime, what we've been doing with regard to domestic abuse. And so there's been a number of initiatives that we've been working in a very bipartisan way. Yeah, and I would say that, yes, Washington has become extremely partisan. There's a, you know, the challenge, I think, of the back and forth and, you know, no holds barred politics that goes on in Washington. And I think what we're doing is we're setting an example for how government can operate. And it doesn't have to be as nasty and vitriolic as it can be and has been in Washington.
Governor has vetoed a number of pieces of pretty major legislation that the legislature overrode those vetoes and, you know, certainly disagrees with. When we think about family leave, there are some transportation issues, some education issues. What does that mean when we talk about a two-party system?
Right.
The legislature passes a bunch of laws that the governor thinks are a bad idea, vetoes it, then the legislature overrides that veto. Then where do we stand? Is that an Well, an example of bipartisanship or just
disagreement among friends in many cases. And in some cases, like there was a transportation bill, which the governor called the roadkill bill, that they passed, which would have set out how they would allocate road construction money. And the governor vetoed it. They overrode it. And then the next year they went back and they corrected that. So it was one of those understanding the implications of the legislature, that the reasons that the governor vetoed it, they were able to come back and correct it. There's some areas where we just feel it's bad. It's bad policy. And the legislature will override it. The family leave. We had an alternative proposal to what the legislature was putting forward. They wanted 15 employees or more. We said, well, we'll give tax breaks for those that don't qualify or don't hit that level, but we think the number should be higher. We started at 50, we came down, but we felt 15 was too small. And so they overrode the veto. That's what the law we have now, and we go forward. But we've had many more successes than those types of situations.
There's a email from Klaus Philipson, who's an architect and urban planner, who begs to disagree with your assertion that the red line did not connect to the other systems. Klaus Philipson has certainly studied this quite intently.
So where is he saying it?
The line is designed connected directly to MARC, to light rail at Howard and Lombard, and to Metro within one block. So
No, that's not true. That's not true. That Howard is not a connection, and it is not a direct connect to those lines.
We won't litigate that here.
They're two long blocks between. You would say that the light rail connects at State Center with Metro, which is two long blocks apart from each other. That's not a connection. New York subway, you go upstairs or downstairs to another train. Metro in D.C., you go upstairs or downstairs to another train. You don't walk two or three blocks to another place that it connects. So I disagree with the astute architect.
Okay. We just got a couple minutes left. 34% of voters voted for Mr. Trump in 2016. What, as a Republican?
Maryland.
In Maryland. Not nearly enough to win,
right.
but still it's 34,000 people, 34% of the public is nearly a million people, right? What is your responsibility to them, people who do embrace Mr. Trump? I mean, 89% of national Republicans support Mr. Trump, and something like 89%, according to the Gonzales poll just released today, also of Maryland Republicans support Mr. Trump. So what is your, there's the bipartisan pitch that you want to make to voters, right, and people can understand that, but what is your responsibility to the people who think Mr. Trump and his disruptive demeanor is a good thing?
Well, our point is we're focused on Maryland. And the issues, most issues that confront a person on a day-to-day basis are state and local issues. The federal government deals with our national air quality, they deal with national defense, and they fund a lot of stuff. They're a big bank for us. But day-to-day, when it comes to your roads, your schools, your law enforcement, that is what, at the Chesapeake Bay, that is what the job of Maryland elected officials is, and we are focused on Maryland. We don't get caught up in all those reindeer games associated with what is going on.
But even if the political philosophy is different from what they voted for.
Yeah. Well, in some cases, we're going to disagree. I mean, I don't agree with my wife on everything. And so there are going to be things we disagree on. But on the greater picture, what we are doing in Maryland, I think that those 30% of Trump supporters are willing to agree with us on those major issues that confront them on a day-to-day basis.
All right, and we have to call it quits right there, and I appreciate it. Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford, he is standing for re-election with Governor Larry Hogan. They are running against Democrats Ben Jealous and Susan Turnbull, plus some third-party candidates in November. Nice to see you, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope you'll come back.
Okay, thank you very much.
Coming up after a break, analysis with Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're having a conversation with Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford, who was originally scheduled to have to leave right after that last segment, but has now said he can stick around for a little bit. And joining us is Luke Broadwater. He covers politics and all sorts of other stuff for the Baltimore Sun. Luke, good to see you, sir.
Good afternoon.
And we got Luke's microphone will get turned on in just a second. Uh-oh. Here. We had a little last-minute switch on things. So, Governor or Lieutenant Governor, let's talk a little bit about education and the approach to education with the Hogan-Rutherford administration. The governor's made a good bit of raised a good bit of hay about the amount of money that has been dedicated to education, but the results in Maryland schools have not been terrific. How do you reconcile those?
Well, and that's why we've been calling for greater accountability. Yes, we are putting a lot of money. The taxpayers, the Maryland citizens, want a big investment in education. Our second to probably Medicaid, and then if you include the higher education, our largest portion of our budget is education. And we proposed last year to have an investigator general to be able to investigate issues associated with the schools. We saw there were some mold issues in Howard County, issues in Baltimore County. There was an audit done down in Prince George's. And so, you know, trying to understand where the money is going and what kind of accountability there really is. In many cases, the school boards, I don't think, really hold their superintendents and the officials as accountable as they probably could. And so we wanted, on at least a state level, to be able to take a closer look in how these operations, how they're operating their organizations.
Earlier in the show today, we talked about the approach to opioid epidemic. And you made mention of the fact that it was so important for local jurisdictions to handle that problem in ways that are, you know, most fitting for them. It's a different situation in Harford County than it is in Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. Why doesn't that same principle apply to education?
Oh, it does.
I mean, the governor has suggested a sort of inspector general, a sort of a person who would oversee, you know, Prince George's County, Baltimore County, Baltimore City.
No, I think you're going a little further. It's not oversee, but to have the ability at the state level to investigate issues that may come up. The issue in Prince George's County, it was three members of the school board were outvoted and they felt that there were problems going on. The teachers were contacting the school board, but also contacting our office. The local NAACP contacted our office saying that there were these problems associated with the graduation rates. There wasn't a mechanism at the state board to be able to go in and do this investigation. And then everyone agreed, including and particularly the delegation. The legislators in Prince George's County called for an outside audit of these graduation rates. So we wouldn't have had to go through all those processes. These school board members wouldn't have had to, you know, basically disrupt the school board. The NAACP would not have had to get involved in that process if we had someone that could at least do that investigation, go in and look at it. So it is still saying local control on the curriculum. But in cases where you need better accountability, where there's something is wrong, to have that outside force coming in.
Let me bring up another example.
And it's not like they're going to have, you know, subpoena power, or they're going to be able to arrest someone like an inspector general at, you know, some department in downtown Washington.
Another thing that comes to mind is Verlita White, who is the superintendent of Baltimore County Schools. The Baltimore County School Board voted to offer her a permanent contract after she served as an interim superintendent. And the Secretary of Education here in Maryland sort of overrode that decision based on some complaints from some of the people who voted against extending her contract permanently. They were outvoted, outnumbered on the board, but their position held sway. Is that another example? What do you say to people who look at that and say, you know, the local control of the schools is important. The state has no business getting involved in a vote by the Baltimore County School Board.
Well, you understand that the State Department of Education is an independent agency. The governor does appoint people to the board, but they select the superintendent. And the superintendent was selected with the last board. It was her decision with regard to how to handle that situation. And as I understand it, there was still an investigation going on when they decided to elect her or make her the permanent member. And what the superintendent said is we need to wait until the full investigation is completed. So it is some oversight, but it isn't the kind of investigation that the state can do.
Luke Broadwater, you have a question for the lieutenant governor?
Sure. Yeah. You guys recently opened a campaign office in Baltimore. Why did you choose the site you did, North Avenue?
We thought it was right in the center of town. It was a good location, and we were able to get a good price for it.
And one of the things I remember Governor Hogan said there to the crowd was basically don't let anyone tell you how to vote.
Right.
Don't vote by party. Don't vote vote for who you think is the best candidate. And I think a poll today showed you guys are doing pretty well in Baltimore. What do you have to say about your commitment and inroads into the city?
Well, I haven't seen the details of the poll. I heard about it, but what the governor was saying was, you know, don't let anybody else tell you how to vote. That it, just because you live in Baltimore City or because you happen to be black doesn't mean that you have to vote a particular way. Make a choice in that. And I tell people that all the time. You know, make the parties compete for your vote. You know, for many years, I think the Democratic Party has taken the black vote for granted, feeling you're going to be with us, 90% of you are going to be with us, so, you know, we'll talk to you and we'll do some things. And the Republican Party has said, you're not going to vote for us, so we don't really even need to listen to what you have to say. So if you make the parties compete for your vote, I think we have a better democracy. And I think that's what we've been saying to folks in Baltimore City. We campaigned in Baltimore City during our campaign 4 years ago, you know, 4 years ago. And we were in areas which people were surprised we would be there. They had to ask us, well, first of all, nobody knew who we were anyway. But then they'd say, what are you guys, independents? We say, no, we're Republicans. And then a couple of people were, oh, my goodness, no way, no Republicans here. But as we talked to them, we said, look, you're complaining about, you know, vacant houses or whatever the case may be. But by voting for the same people, and this is where I said the opposition party, by voting for the same people, you're basically telling people it's okay, that all of this is fine, because you're voting for the same people who've been here for the last 10 or 15 years. You know, give us a chance. Give us, you know, a chance to show that we can be different. And so we've been in the communities.
But what about the voters who say, okay, we gave you guys a chance, and you took away the red line, you have
but let me say, we never
state senator.
Well, state senator was a bad deal.
And the governor has his support for PIMLICO and the revitalization of Park Heights has been people would say it should be.
That is bad. We have not said anything about PIMLICO. We've said that we want to keep the Preakness in Baltimore. We have an initiative in Park Heights now. You need to talk to our Department of Housing and Community Development in terms of the investment. We're working with a number of the churches and faith groups up in Park Heights. I met with a group of churches today, including a church from Park Heights. So we're working in that community. We never promised the red line. If you go back and listen to us in the campaign,
no, that's absolutely true.
So don't throw the red line in as if we did not. You know, we were honest with people that we did not support the red line from day one. And as I already told you, the State Center project is only a boondoggle for those developers. $55 a square foot. If we wanted to move out of State Center, which we're not planning to do, we could go downtown in the Central Business District for $19 a square foot and get very nice office space right in the midst of the transit lines, you know, help to revitalize downtown Baltimore, particularly in the Central Business District, as things have moved east.
Because
so that was
it's not
$55 a square foot. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's certainly more expensive than what the state is paying. However, is there also not an ancillary benefit to the neighborhoods around State Center?
Yeah,
and
those neighborhoods
that
pay taxes
hub?
Too. And we have a responsibility to all the taxpayers. Those neighborhoods are paying taxes too. And right now, yes, you're right. There is a challenge there because after dark, that place becomes a deserted land. And we want to revitalize it. But this isn't the deal to do it. You don't just take the worst deal just to get it done. Okay. And we would have been stuck for years paying $55 a square foot and it going up, continue to go up.
And so, what's the right amount that we should be paying?
Whatever the market is.
And you think $55 a square foot is higher than market rate?
Yes, it is. It's higher than even downtown. Come on.
All right. Luke, you got anything
else? You can check that out. I mean,
I'm just trying to put it in perspective for people.
Think about Harbor East and the office buildings down there. You know, what you pay for that. You pay less on Pratt Street than what you pay on down there in Harbor East. You pay less on Charles, you know, than you would pay there.
But renting an office on Pratt Street or renting an office on Charles Street isn't going to help fix the neighborhoods around State Center.
I understand that part, but we can do that. But at $55 a square foot, it makes absolutely no sense. You don't throw all this good money in there. And they weren't going to do what they said they were going to do. They weren't going to get it done. They was all pie in the sky.
Luke Broadway.
Yeah, I think you already talked about opioids earlier. Yes. But did we get a specific answer to a Dr. Wen in Baltimore has said that she needs more money for this life-saving
we've
drugs.
We've given a lot of money. In our last round of the additional monies, she got, I don't have the exact number, and we can get that number from for you, in terms of the dollar amounts that we gave her that she could buy naloxone. So that is not an issue right now. And we can talk to her further that, you know, naloxone is widely available, and she has it. She has the money to utilize for naloxone.
Well, she's told me just within the last 2 weeks that they're still rationing naloxone in the city.
How do you ration naloxone?
Well, she's told me
that's a question.
How do you ration naloxone? You decide who doesn't get it.
So that means she's letting people die?
Dr. Nguyen has sat where you're sitting, sir, and told me that they are
Dr. Nguyen, call me. Okay?
We can tell
you. I mean, I've talked to Dr. Nguyen, but how do you ration? She said that there's not enough.
I'm just repeating what I'm told.
That means somebody's dying. Is she letting people die? Is that what she told you?
She is saying that it's a very serious, there's a shortage of naloxone, not because the drug is not available, but because the funds to purchase it are not available. She's not necessarily blaming the state, but she says that the federal government could do more and that there's plenty of people.
And what about the city, too? You know, how much is she getting from the city on that as well?
We have provided additional money
just in the last few months to Dr. Nguyen and the health department for naloxone or for anything else that she wanted. We put $2 million into opening up that stabilization center. We're committed to put another $3 million in this year or next year, actually. So we're doing a lot to assist in the issues in Baltimore City. I don't want to speak
for Dr. Nguyen, but I'm just telling you, we have had that conversation
on this very program. We can certainly put you two in touch. We have both your numbers. What was the old three students?
Let's talk about health care. We just have a minute left, sir.
Okay.
Let's talk about health care and the destabilizing effects that the Trump administration has put into the ACA and what the state of Maryland can do to help right that ship.
Well, we recently signed an agreement with Medicaid, Medicare on the national level to stabilize our system and stabilize our hospitals with regard to Medicare in particular. That was a kind of a landmark decision that had been worked on for several months, almost a year to get that taken care of. I am not the expert on ACA and all that we can do on the state level, state side, to address any challenges associated with the ACA and where it's going. I think there were some challenges with the ACA to begin with, and I think Congress didn't do and hasn't done a good job in trying to correct any issues that were there in terms of rates, in terms of the private market. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, but again, I am not the expert on that.
Well, that is all the time we have, and I do appreciate your being able to stay a few extra minutes. And as I said, hope you'll come back. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Mr. Broadwater, it's always a pleasure to see you, sir.
And, yeah, that was a nice little cameo at the end.
a little cameo
appearance.
All right, Luke Broadwater covers politics and much more for the Baltimore Sun. Boyd Rutherford is the lieutenant governor of the state of Maryland. If you've not yet registered to vote, you have until October 16th. Early voting begins on October 25th. That's in 72 days. Election Day is November 6th. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, three Baltimore City public school teachers join me to share their thoughts on the state of the schools as the new academic year gets underway. Karen Ginyard teaches third grade at Mount Washington School. Tavon McGee teaches math at City Springs Middle School. And Bobby Marinelli heads the math department at Poly High School. They'll talk about the issues that they think are the most important in Baltimore City schools. They'll join us tomorrow here on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared's
serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate you listening. Have a great day.